And by Chico State Continuing Education and the Open University Program. Open University opens doors to new educational and career opportunities, letting you take Chico State classes on a space available basis without being admitted. Classes and registration begin August 24th. More information at 898-6105 and at openu.csuchico.edu. And by the North Valley Catholic Social Services. There is currently a tremendous need for foster parents in Butte County, Glenn County, and Tehama County. NVCSS is looking for families that would like to add light and love to their homes and help transform the life of a youth. For more information or to get involved, visit nvcss.org/casa or call 844-254-2272 and help inspire hope and transform a life. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Cover just a little more ground. All right. Welcome to The Wheel. I'm Rebecca Chenelou, your local voice in the international movement to bring death out of the closet. I'm very happy to have you here to join the conversation as we consider the mysteries of living, dying, preparing for death, loving, grieving, and honoring our dead. This show is about creating community, and that's the reason I do this. So I invite you to participate by sharing your input on our Facebook page at The Wheel Mysteries. Go ahead and pull it up now. Before we get started, let's thank some of the underwriters who make this show possible. The Wheel is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner to the California Arts Council since 2001. Friends of the Arts creates economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and by publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with the Hightower Group, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with compassionate, quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. Okay, someone is trying to call in and I can't pick up the phone right now. Welcome back to this episode of The Wheel. Tonight we're going to explore a mystery that most of us would rather avoid like the plague. It's a subject that we rarely explore except by necessity. And it will be necessary because this experience is as universal and as human as the experience of love. Yes, we love to love. But most of us don't like to talk about or even think about grief, which is the natural result of losing something we love. Unfortunately, according to experts, this very aversion, this unwillingness to engage with grief, both as individuals and as a culture, actually causes us extended suffering and harm. This show is about tenderly and courageously opening the door on end-of-life topics like grief, with the understanding that exploring these mysteries now will reveal understanding that can help us when we face these things, when death inevitably comes. So tonight is our chance to learn more about bearing the unbearable. In preparation for this show, I read the book of that title by Joanne Cacciatore, and it has become my new favorite book on love and loss, so you'll hear me mention it more than once. Joanne, like both of my guests tonight, gained her experience through the loss of a child. And yet, as the foreword of the book describes, and this is a quote, "Bearing the unbearable is filled with heartwarming stories and original insights. It shows that pain can be a doorway into wisdom and fierce compassion. This book will expand your mind, warm your heart, and enrich your spirit. Bearing the unbearable is not just a critique of grief avoidance and a plea for empathy and compassion, but it is also an invitation to a life of openness and care, courage, and service." Unquote. Maybe not what you would expect from a grief book. And believe me, she in no way sugarcoats the brutal pain of loss. But again and again, she comes back to her point, which is that when we have the courage to feel our pain, when we allow ourselves to grieve, we deepen and we become more whole. So if you're going to turn this show off, please make a note first that my new recommended book on grief and loss is Bearing the Unbearable. Then you'll have that resource if you need it. As most of you know, a regular feature of The Wheel is hearing real-life stories from real-life people in our This American Death segment. And tonight we'll be hearing from my friend Tammy Markham Smith, whose son Benjamin died in 2015. And it's a beautiful story of love and strength. My interview is with my friend Malama McNeil. And in our conversation, she mentions how our grief stories are also our love stories. And I agree. Powerful, powerful love stories. As usual, we will have an exit tip for your exit plan. and some music and inspiration to hold it all together. We hope you plan to stay with us the whole show, but if you don't, the show will be archived at kzfr.org for about 2 weeks, and I will also try to post a version of the show on Facebook at The Wheel Mysteries and on SoundCloud, and that one's under my name, Rebecca Chenelou. Now, some of you may be feeling nervous about this show because you feel the weight of your own grief and wonder if this show will make you feel worse. In the spirit of the wisdom that will be shared tonight, I invite you to try to just be with whatever comes up and to take care of yourself. That's really the skill that we're trying to learn here. Know that I bow down to you and I wish I could give you a hug. And I promise that we will try to avoid platitudes. We don't need platitudes. That's one of the first lessons of grief. And so let us begin with a poem by Edna St. Vincent Millay, dismantling one of the most common platitudes about grief. The one that says, "Time heals all wounds." And the poem is titled, "Time does not bring relief. You all have lied." Here we go. Time does not bring relief. You all have lied who told me time would ease me of my pain. I miss him in the weeping of the rain. I want him at the shrinking of the tide. The old snows melt from every mountainside, and last year's leaves are smoke in every lane. But last year's bitter loving must remain heaped on my heart, and my old thoughts abide. There are 100 places where I fear to go, so with his memory they brim. And entering with relief some quiet place where never fell his foot or shone his face, I say, "There is no memory of him here," and so stand stricken, so remembering him. One person's experience. Let's hear another. I had not talked to my friend Tammy in 30 years. I had heard about her son's death through our mutual friend and had reached out with a message online, but getting to talk with her, being able to hear her sweet voice and feel in my heart that connection even after so many years, it was a great joy and a reminder of how satisfying it is to connect on a deep level, sharing stories. I think that hearing other people's stories of grief and sharing our own can help us make some sense of the mystery of grief, of how it works, and how we as humans are wired to make our way through it. So let's listen to Tammy as she shares her story. Here we go.
And I'm married with two sons.
I'm going to go back and try that again.
My name is Tammy Smith, and I live in Savannah, Georgia. I'm an art teacher, and I'm married with two sons. And I'm going to be talking about my son, my oldest son, Benjamin, who passed away on January 15th in 2015. Benjamin was only 27 when he passed away. He was a very creative individual, lots of fun. He was always that guy that was on the cutting edge of everything. I mean, all of the latest music, books, movies, videos, TV shows. He was always a prankster. He loved his family a lot. He had a good heart. He loved to share with people. Sometimes he would give money away or give cigarettes away to homeless people that he might meet. He cared for people. The night before Benjamin passed away, he had gone out with one of his friends, a person that I didn't particularly like or trust. And Benjamin had been in recovery for alcohol and drug abuse several years ago, and he was doing quite well. He had a job as an electrician, and he loved it. He was living at home, And we shared, you know, day in and day out, all about our lives. This particular night, he went out with his friend and came home. And his very best friend had driven down from Atlanta. And so Tyler was here, and he was going to spend the night. The guys went into Ben's room to listen to music or watch TV or whatever. And about 12, I went and knocked on the door and kissed Benjamin goodnight and told him that I loved him. And he said, "I love you too, Mama. I'll see you in the morning." And Tyler was asleep, sitting in a chair. And I said, "You really need to get Tyler into bed." I said, "He looks very uncomfortable." So he said, "Yeah, I thought so. I'm going to do that." And then I went to Ben. The next morning, my youngest son, Jonathan, was going to make a big breakfast for everyone. And so he and I were discussing what he was going to cook. And he went to Whole Foods to buy the supplies. And while he was gone, I was sitting on the sofa. I don't remember what I was doing, but his best friend, Tyler, came running out of the bedroom and said, "Something's wrong with Ben." No, he said, "Something is wrong with your son." And I said, "Come on, Tyler, quit trying to pull a joke on me. I know how you guys are." And he said, "No, I'm serious. I can't wake him up. And he feels cold." And I immediately ran into the bedroom, and Ben was on his knees in the corner, and I grabbed him and pulled him to me and laid him on the floor. He threw up all over me. And Tyler had called 911, and he was trying to do CPR on Ben, and Gary came in the meantime. And of course, we were both just screaming and crying. We didn't know if he was dead or not at that point. But after that, it was kind of a blur because the EMS were here, the police were here. They went through everything in his room, and Gary went with them. And they found several needles. And we found out later that it wasn't Benjamin who was using the needles, but Tyler. Tyler shot up in my house and then sat and lied to me in my face because I said, "What were you guys doing? What was going on? What did Ben say?" And I got no response, you know. And so I just assumed he was innocent. And we found out later by text messages on Ben's phone and that he had been dabbling in drugs again. So some friends came by. We called some friends, and they came quickly over to sit with us. And at one point, the police wanted us to move out into the yard because they wanted to remove the body. By that time, we knew he was dead. And so we were all out in the yard, and they were wheeling him out to the EMS. And I said, "Can I see him one more time?" And I don't recall if it was a man or a woman responder, but they said, You don't want to see him like this. You don't want to see him like this." And so they drove away, and I immediately just basically collapsed, and I just sat in the yard, and it was just, everything was so surreal. And the days went past, and, you know, I couldn't tell you exactly what happened because it was just such a blur. That night, later on that night, when I was going to bed, though, I closed my eyes. I wasn't asleep, but I sincerely heard in Benjamin's voice, "Mom, I am so, so sorry." The main thing that helped us cope with Benjamin's death was our friends, our people. I work at a small country school that's several miles outside of Savannah, and these are very wonderful, ultra-religious, lovely ladies. And Gary and I had gone somewhere. I don't know if we were making arrangements, but we pulled onto our street, and we saw this whole parade. It looked like a clown car of women carrying casseroles into our house, and it was just... it was just the funniest sight. But they would come by. They would make sure that we had everything we needed. They would wash the dishes. They would sweep the floor. They just surrounded us with love. And one of my friends, Kim, who's a very strong Southern Baptist lady, she said, well, we can feed you, we can love you, and we can pray for you. But whatever else you need, you're going to have to tell us. Those ladies, really, I had no idea. I was washed over with all of this tenderness and care from everybody I knew. And I was just surprised. You know, it just blew me away how much we were loved. We had Benjamin's memorial service just a week after he passed away at our Unitarian Universalist Church. And Ben was not a religious person. And as a matter of fact, when he was going through recovery, he decided that he couldn't say higher power. So he just decided that his higher power was physics. And so at the memorial, we knew that Ben wouldn't want some flowery prayers and that sort of thing. So we decided to do the one thing that was the most important to him, and that was music. The entire service was music with breaks in between for friends and family to get up and talk about Benjamin and how he affected their lives. And it was truly wonderful. It was so lovely. The church is small. It holds 200 people. So the church was completely full. People were lining the wall and the back of the church. So I have no idea how many people were actually there. And after the memorial service, we went to the cemetery. Gary's family has a plot there, and he was cremated. We wanted to do something to mark this occasion, to make it memorable for everybody who came. And I know that in the Jewish tradition, when someone dies, they put a rock on that person's marker or tombstone. But in this case, we decided that everyone would pick out a stone and take it away. And so we had a basket full of black smooth stones, and everyone who wanted to, who was at the cemetery, collected a stone before they went. And we've had pictures from friends and showing us all of the places they've traveled with Ben. Some of his friends send me photos of, here's Ben's rock. He's being protected by all of these action figures. And he's gone all over Europe with his best friend, Joe. He's, you know, gone to different coasts. We've taken him to the mountains and to Europe and all sorts of places. It's just a way to keep him with us. I think, you know, the thing that was most helpful was having those few cherished people that I could share my real emotions with. Gary and I would just sometimes sit and just sob on the sofa. He's been a great source of strength. We also, after a couple of months, I think, we went to hospice, to a grief counseling group, and that was very helpful. I always felt like whenever I would get upset and begin to cry, that it was painful for the other person I was talking to. And so I was very guarded about who I would tell things to. But at this place, everybody was in the same place as I was. So if I wanted to sit there and cry for the 2 hours, it was perfectly fine because everyone understood what was going on. So that was a very, very good thing that we decided to do. I only regret that my youngest son, Jonathan, refused to participate. He sort of shut down after his brother died for a very long time. The thing that was the least helpful was probably those people who were well-meaning, but they would say things like, oh, God will never give you more than, you know, you can handle. And at one point, I just turned around and I said, you mean if I was a weaker person, that my son might be alive? Is that what you're saying? And that, you know, that was the worst thing, I think, as well as the pain and the pity that I saw in people's faces. But I did have a core group of good friends who would just sit and listen and hear the story and let me talk about Ben. I've lost a lot of people in my life. I lost my two older brothers and my mother and father and my grandparents, of course. But this was the absolute hardest thing that has ever happened to me. And it changed me on a molecular level. at one point I finally had to make the decision that I wasn't going to let this hurt define me. And I got help and I got medication. And it's really only been in about the last year that I'm starting to feel sort of normal again. I still have those days, those moments when I hear a song or I see something and I break down. But I think that's just to be expected. I read this great quote about how when you're grieving at the beginning, it's sort of like you're in the ocean and the waves are just crashing over you. You're nearly drowning. And then the longer the time, it becomes less and less. It still splashes over you every once in a while, but it's not like in the beginning. And just been in the last 6 months that I can actually talk about him without crying. If I meet someone new and they say, oh, do you have children? And I can say, I have a son, Jonathan, who is a student at Georgia Southern, and I have one son who passed away. And I can say that without breaking down. And I really feel like that it's strengthened me as a person in a lot of different ways. I never knew I was this strong, really. I never thought of myself as being this strong of a person. But having lived through this, I know that I am one.
Somehow that got cut off. One strong broad, I remember, is what she said. You know, I edited some of the pauses out of that, and I'm feeling like I need a pause just to soak it all in. Tammy, thank you so much. That's a hard story to tell, I think, and yet full of so many powerful images. I can see the women with their casseroles marching into your house, and I appreciate so much the ritual you came up with of the stones and how it allowed people to remember Ben and take him with them all over the world and share that being with him, with you, and with each other. I wonder, listeners, what stood out for you? What are you thinking after this story? And we're going to take a moment to listen to a song just to kind of have a little time to soak in what we've just heard.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone. Suzanne, the plans they made put an end to you. I walked out this morning and I wrote down this song. I just can't remember who to send it to. I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Won't you look down upon me, Jesus? You gotta help me make a stand. You just got to see me through another day. My body's aching and my time is at hand. And I won't make it any other way. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you again. Been walking my mind to an easy time, my back turned towards the sun. Lord knows when the cold wind blows,
knows it'll turn your head around. Well, there's hours of time on the telephone line to talk about things to come. Sweet dreams and flying machines in pieces on the ground. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain. I've seen sunny days that I thought would never end. I've seen lonely times when I could not find a friend. But I always thought that I'd see you, baby, one more time again now. Thought I'd see you one more time again. There's just a few things coming my way this time around now.
So, I'd like to thank our underwriters again. The Wheel is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters, that's all of you, and the Four Bay Aquatic Center in Oroville, just minutes from Chico. The center offers rentals of kayaks, stand-up paddle boards, pedal boats, and more. Hours are Friday through Sunday, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Also available weekly youth aquatic camps and monthly sailing classes for all ages. Visit forbayaquaticcenter.com for details. Every day is a fun day at the Four Bay. And by Members First Credit Union, created by the community for the community, Members First is a member-owned, not-for-profit financial institution providing checking, savings, loans, and credit cards to residents of Butte, Glen, Shasta, and Tehama counties. For more information, visit m1cu.org. I want to go back for a minute to Fire and Rain. You know, James Taylor achieved his breakthrough to the top of the charts in 1970 with this song about grief. And 50 years later, we still resonate with the loss he's able to express so beautifully in that song. Grief is as old as our human experience. Songs and stories about grief have been with us since ancient times. And you would think by now we would have figured it out. But in many ways, it seems to me that we've gone backwards and we suffer a sort of grief illiteracy. My friend Malama McNeil and I have been working for years to encourage a shift in awareness around dying and grief. Because from what we've learned and all the stories we've heard, being willing to talk about and be with death and grief around us helps us to live more healthy and meaningful lives. Yes, grief hurts. It's disruptive. We understandably want to avoid it. And it teaches us to love more deeply and be better humans with each other. Like Tammy said, it made her stronger. What do you think? What has been your experience? What is forming your beliefs around death and grief? I think one of the ways we shift culture is by encouraging conversations. And tonight I'm going to invite you to participate in the shift by joining our conversation about the mysteries of grief and grieving. I'm going to be talking with Malama McNeil, and she's a native of the Central Valley and has lived in Chico for 35 years. She's now retired. She was a longtime care provider, a manual therapist, and a hospice volunteer. She co-founded with me the Alliance for Support and Education in Dying and Death, which presented events and services and study groups in Chico for nearly a decade. And she continues as a community elder, grief tender, educator, and ceremonialist. After the campfire, Malama hosted circles of support. And now, while sheltering in place during the pandemic, she co-facilitates online groups in mind, body, skills for resilient self-care.
Here's Tonight, Malama. We come together to talk about grief and grieving. And grief is a vast topic. What is the message you feel most strongly needs to be shared with our listeners about grief?
Well, I'll start by making a fundamental distinction between grief, which is like the abstract noun, you know, the label, and grieving, which is the spontaneous whole being experience that we have in response to the, you know, impact of changes in our life. Changes like traumatic injury or the loss of a loved one, unemployment or divorce. A lot of times we think grief is about the sadness that results and neglect to recognize that there's a lot of different feelings that come up as we are grieving, as we are responding to a fundamental like reorientation of our whole relationship with other people and with how things ought to be. So I always want to start there. I'd like to say, let's talk about grieving, not just grief.
And why do you think that distinction is so important?
When we talk about grief, people go, oh, it's about sadness, and maybe don't recognize that the incredible rage that they're flying into apropos of nothing is also an expression of their state of being in grieving, or their sudden timidity. You know, they don't want to even go out the gate. They're afraid to drive, and they don't know that's also a grieving response to a loss. I like to say grieving, you know, is a big territory. Grief is one of the feeling states that we pass through as we're journeying in that territory. So is fear. So is guilt. And that isn't necessarily called up when you just say grief.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So, Malama, you've been exploring grief and the different ways of being with people who are grieving for decades. And I'd like to know what drew you to this work. I mean, why so many years of working with sorrow and suffering?
Well, first of all, I would say it's not just sorrow and suffering. there are surprising moments of joy and levity even. Yeah, what drew me to this work was my daughter, Fiona's my middle child of the five that I gave birth to, her growing disability. And eventually she was diagnosed with a terminal condition. That diagnosis and the recognition that she was not going to live a full and rich life led to encountering the work of a man named Ken Moses, who was a psychotherapist and a parent of a child with disabilities, who presented workshops for years to parents and professionals who were working with the grieving that results from the disability of a child. The more I learned about grieving, and the longer I identified and observed and experienced my own and others, the more I came to appreciate that grieving is really transformative. I mean, what caught my attention when I met Ken, when I first went to a workshop with Ken, was that he described the craziness that the diagnosis of my daughter had introduced into my life, and the pain and the anguish, and said, that's grieving. And that's maybe the bad news, but it's also the good news, because grieving leads to something. It leads to a transformation of everything you think you know, everything you ever believed about, you know, how you have to be in the world. And you come out the other end of that transformation with a much more authentic relationship with the ones you love, with yourself, your identity, and your relationship to your creator and all the rest of the world. So there was like this light at the end of the tunnel. You become more human, and that seemed like it was worth pursuing. And as I sit and witness to others grieving, I see that over and over again. I had a dear friend here in Chico who one time in a circle where people were telling their stories of grief, it was shortly after the campfire. She said, you know, when I listen to people telling the stories of what it is that they are grieving, I hear love stories. I hear the stories of what it is that they have loved, the place that they loved, or the person, the work that they did that they loved. And why wouldn't you, if you had the opportunity to hear people tell their love stories just straight out? And that has been my experience.
Yeah, and you've done a lot of things since Ken Moses. I mean, you mentioned the campfire circles. I know we met, I think we originally met through hospice almost 20 years ago. Yeah. You were doing bereavement work, and maybe you want to say how else it's been a part of your work.
Yeah, well, for many years I was also a hands-on healer, and I very quickly learned to recognize that when people were recovering from injury and I would put my hands on them, it's a process of like physical grieving and bearing witness to that and saying, yes, yes, this is part of the range of being in a body, is that it gets hurt and it knows how to heal itself. And when the healing is complete, when the unwinding of the damage, the guarding that just happens naturally, kind of like the denial that we enter into when there's a grievous loss. We go like, oh, I don't want to go there. I don't want to feel that. I don't even want to hear it. Let's not talk about it. That diagnosis has got to be wrong. We deny the fact, or we deny the feeling, or we deny that we're going to have to do anything differently or be any different than we've already been. That's all in that territory of grieving. That's part of the process.
Maybe this would be a point where we could address some of the myths about grieving. I think you and I have heard plenty of the feeling that if you just make it quickly through your stages, you'll be done.
Yeah, right. The biggest myth about grieving that I'm aware of, you've just alluded to, that there's a predictable course that grieving takes, and that's basically predicated on the idea that grief is some sort of pathology that we can and we should recover from. We should be healed. that our grief could be healed. But grieving is a whole mind, body, spirit experience, and it doesn't have a predictable course. It doesn't pass through predictable stages, stage one, stage two, stage three, and there's an exit. We live with our grief. We become more able to include it in our sense of who we are. What Ken used to say was that what he was offering was a map through the territory of grieving. And there were various states, feeling states that we passed through. And I've mentioned a couple of them. There is sadness, and there's anger, and there's fear, and there's guilt. And there's denial, always denial, which we enter into naturally, automatically, and it is not pathological. We enter into that until we can build the capacity and we can find the resources to actually take in whatever the change is that's precipitated our grieving.
And I think people often have very unrealistic ideas of what that time frame is. You and I have both been involved with bereavement groups, and I remember so clearly the widow who came in 3 years after the death. For 3 years, she had needed to just raise her kids and get to work. And, celebrated Christmas in Hawaii, and, they were doing things like this just to get to the point where then she, 3 years later, said, now I can deal with this. I need to deal with this now. Breaks my heart when I see people beating themselves up because they're still grieving. It's a very unrealistic time frame that most people hold. It's always there. If you've lost a child, if you've lost a spouse, the part of you that wants to always love them will also always grieve them.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, if you've lost a home, as so many local folks did in the campfire, and I've met folks who said, well, I should be moving on, and I have those days where I just have fire brain. I can't do anything. I'm not motivated. I don't have any energy. I'm just so sad. Sometimes they actually connect it to, it's about that loss. I was reminded of something about my house, or the garden, or the tree that every spring, gave me so much joy. And we don't just one, two, three and out.
So let's talk a little bit about community. You know, although grief is a shared human experience, it's often a very lonely experience. And I think that's particularly true in the West, where we've tossed aside many of the community traditions around mourning. What things do you think we can do better as a community when it comes to grief and mourning our dead?
I'm often sorry that we don't still have the customs, you know, the black wreath on the door, or the armband, or dressing in black for, you know, and everybody understanding that because you're in mourning, and things like 3 days bereavement leave. Okay, and now back to work. I think what we as a community can do is inform ourselves and you know, read books that help us understand that we are all grieving, or listen to podcasts where there's discussion of that, or just sit with someone that you know who is recently bereaved, or who mentions that they feel like they're just always too sad, too afraid to really live fully, and ask them to tell you about it. Ask them to talk about their beloved.
Malama, you have a great story that explains the ways that these mourning rituals can help not only the living, but maybe even the dead. Why don't you share that with us?
Yeah. So we were in a compound. I was visiting in West Africa in Burkina Faso, and about the third night, I think, everybody in the compound, 30, 40 people, were waked in the middle of the night by this sound of a woman's voice. And it really was not a sound that I had ever heard before. I mean, it was like unlike anything this Euro-American girl from California ever heard. And I recognized it immediately as the sound of someone in utter anguish and mourning. And this woman just kept calling, crying out for about an hour. And then we heard from a nearby compound, you know, about half a mile away, the sound of the balafon. And I knew from studying a little bit about the culture that I was going to be visiting with that the balafon is used during funerals. And that balafon sound, you know, it's a wooden and gored xylophone kind of sound. That sounded for 3 days, which is how long a funeral lasts. And it could be heard for probably miles away. So her cry, and we learned the next morning it was a young woman who had just heard the news that her father had died rather suddenly, unexpectedly. And that cry, everyone understood, was an announcement. Someone has died. We need to gather. We need to gather for the funeral. We need to gather to grieve and mourn and weep this beloved. They say that the tears of the mourning lift the boat that carries people from the land of the living to the land of the dead. It's a very poetic way of putting, you know, their belief about how we help the dead really leave. And that's what happens. There's 3 days of people wailing and weeping and mourning the death. And it's understood that if people don't sufficiently mourn, that folks both may not make it all the way across, and they'll be stuck here as ghosts. So you really want to help them get to the land of the dead, from where they can go to the land of the ancestors, and then they can be with us always as ancestors. It's a different cosmology. It's a different worldview than the one that I grew up in, you know, which is very much influenced. Yeah.
It has an indigenous wisdom to it, which is that it gives permission to the community to grieve, to wail, to cry, and in fact, it's beneficial, you know.
And to come together.
Yeah.
Not to isolate.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. You know, I think that kind of wailing and crying is something that we feel uncomfortable. A lot of times I see people really fighting their tears, and that's just one of the symptoms of our culture's inability to really use these tools that other traditions have. At least very naturally, my last question, which is, what tools tools you might offer someone who's newly bereaved or someone who has old grief to heal?
Yeah. You know, some years ago, there was a young woman who asked for support around her caregiving her father, who was rapidly dying of a very aggressive cancer, because she knew that I'd been a caretaker for a long time, but maybe I knew something, and I felt like maybe I did. I created a couple of pages of advice for caregivers, and not long afterward, I shared that same list with someone who was freshly bereaved and asked my advice about how am I going to get through this. And in that case, the one she was caring for was herself. The list recommended things like it's the usual self-care strategies, you know, eat nourishing food, stay hydrated. Amazing how easy it is to forget to drink water, and avoid excessive consumption of tea and coffee and other psychoactive or stimulant or sedative substances. Rest as much as possible. Rest when you're tired. Spend time out of doors. Minimize interaction with social or news media. Remember, you're in the process of a radical transformation, and you probably feel unprepared for that, but you will likely survive it. Arrange as early as possible in the process to have at least one person who will check in on you. And I also encourage people to, before they need it, identify in their circle of friends or family one or two people that they can call when it feels urgent, you know, when they're in an emergency. Find out, can I call you at 4 a.m.? Because I would have those terrible 3 a.m. I am here all alone dealing with this, and I cannot stand it. I cannot do it for it. It's unbearable. And to know that there was somebody that I could call sometimes was enough. I didn't even have to call. To know that there was somebody who was willing to just hold space for me, to just hear me going, I think we should all have somebody like that, just like we should all have, you know, our agent for medical decisions designated. We should have somebody who is our designated, I could call you in an emergency, an emotional emergency.
I think many are isolated and many are more alone than that. And to that, I would say, after facilitating bereavement groups, that, you know, people hesitate to go to bereavement groups. And when in my experience, people were always so grateful by the end. They learned they were not alone, that there were many others who were feeling alone and maybe did not have a lot of immediate support nearby, but that by going to the group, they created new friendships and created a circle of support that they didn't have before. So I can't speak enough to that. We don't have a lot of the old traditions, but we do have this practice of the bereavement circle in some different contexts around town here that can be really helpful.
There's also been a series of group I've been co-facilitating where we learn a set of 8 to 10 skills that are self-care for kind of resilient recovery. They were designed to serve folks who were impacted by the campfire, but we found that they're equally applicable to folks who are now socially isolated. By the end of the 8 weeks of meeting every week, you know, we were all in love with each other and really felt like we had new friends who we would continue to check in on, at least, you know, just how you doing.
And I know that there are people who listen who don't even use the internet. And so I would say to reach out to some of the local organizations in town, like Passages, who can help you find the phone numbers. There's even phone support available. And that's one of the reasons we have these shows, is to tell people it exists. Malama, I know this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, as you started talking about, you know, the COVID loss, the fire loss, there's just so much. And I talked to me before about ambiguous grief, these things we grieve that don't involve a lost body still causing us this collective response.
I really do love the practice of simply listening deeply to others' experience, however haltingly they may, you know, feel that they are communicating it. It just doesn't get much better than that. And it reminds me that when I've sat in circles with people, that while we've lost those traditional ways of being community, we know them in our bones. We recognize it. We go, oh, this is what I've been looking for. You know, this is just like we all come together and we get to know each other. and then we know each other, and then we're aware of how much we value one another, even our differences. And if we can figure out a way to continue to talk and invite feedback, I'm there.
I think I always invite people to use this show as an excuse for bringing the topic up with someone close to them. So you don't have to have a circle, but you may be at breakfast with your spouse that you've never talked about this stuff with for the 40 years you've been married, and you can start the conversation off by saying, I listened to something on the radio last night that got me thinking and about this time. And then tell a story. Tell a story about a loss, or tell a story about what you hope for or what you fear. And they become the richest conversations. And it happens to me all the time, because I mention the show to people in passing, and then they look at me very strangely, like, you have a show about what? About end of life stuff? You know? And the next thing that comes out of their mouth, I would say 99.9% of the time, is a story. Oh, yeah, well, my wife is dealing with that with her mom, or gosh, my brother died last year, and it's story after story, and the stories are all so poignant. It's so human and powerful, and well, this is why you and I do this, Malama, I know.
Yep.
Thank you so much for being my guest and for bringing your wisdom.
Yes, thanks to Malama for that interview, for that conversation. We're very close to the end of our show, and there's still so much that could be shared about grief. I do want to share for our News in the Movement part to bring death out of the closet. I encourage you to check out the Forbes.com article I posted at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook, which talks about bereavement leave and the progressive changes that Sheryl Sandberg, the chief operating officer of Facebook, brought to that organization after the sudden death of her husband at age 47. Good for Facebook employees, but currently there are no federal laws that require employers to provide employees either paid or unpaid bereavement leave. Also, only one state, Oregon, has passed a law requiring employers to provide bereavement leave. And according to the 2016 Paid Leave in the Workplace survey, on average, employers give workers 4 days following the death of a spouse or a child. 3 days for a domestic partner, foster child, grandchild, a parent, a sibling or grandparent, and 1 or 2 days for extended family members or a spouse's relative. I think that is an unrealistic time frame. What do you think? Before we finish up tonight, I want to leave you with a suggestion for your exit plan. In my mind, the exit plan is all those little things you do to prepare for your death and or the death of your loved ones. We often put these things on the back burner, but tonight, like Malama suggests, I hope you will commit to doing one thing in the near future to better educate yourself about grief. Listen to a podcast. Read a book about grief. The Cancer Center Library has books both skinny and fat that you can check out for free. Or simply engage in a conversation with someone that you know who is bereaved. Ask them how they're doing, and then just listen. And if you are in need of support for your own grieving, contact me, either through Facebook or at the Enloe Cancer Center Library, and I can help you find resources.
This is the story.
I want to close with a quote from the book Bearing the Unbearable. Dr. Cacciatore writes, "Grief violates convention. It is raw, primal, seditious, chaotic, writhing, and most certainly uncivilized. Yet grief is an affirmation of human passion, and only those who are apathetic, who stonewall love, who eschew intimacy, can escape grief's pull. No intervention and no interventionist can cure our grief. And we are not broken. We are broken-hearted. Grief is not a medical disorder to be cured. Grief is not a spiritual crisis to be resolved. Grief is not a social woe to be addressed. Grief is simply a matter of the heart to be felt." Okay, friends, My next episode of The Wheel will be October 29th, the fifth Thursday in October, so mark your calendar. In the time between then and now, let's be in touch. Do you have stories to share, topics you'd like covered, or questions you want answered? Post them at The Wheel Mysteries on Facebook or email me at thewheelmysteries@gmail.com. You can also listen to past shows by digging through past events on the Facebook page. And I invite you to dive in. Share your stories, express your wishes, write them down. And remember, friends, talking about death won't kill you. You are listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Being at its fifth